Thursday night edition of the Dunked On Basketball podcast. With the All-Star break upon us, it is a great time to check in and do our semi-monthly-ish awards pod. This will be our third one of the year. We're basically two-thirds of the way through the season, so this might be the last one we do before the very end. And let's start, of course, with the obvious MVP. Danny, who is your MVP pick?
Big surprise, Stephen Curry.
Is there any chance it could be the guy who's having maybe the greatest season of all time and playing on the team having the greatest season of all time? Could that maybe be the MVP, that guy?
Look at you trying to get for the big narratives.
Well, to me, it gets a lot more interesting, as it has in the past, looking at the remaining slots on the ballot. If we're going to go five deep, what is your two through five?
Okay, two through five, it's a struggle after two. I think Kawhi right now is number two. He benefits from, you know, playing a little bit more than Durant and just those guys. I think he's been spectacular.
And they're phenomenal teams.
Oh, of course. And well, he's such a huge part of it. And we're going to talk about Kawhi in awards another time. But his offensive game has been remarkable this year. I think that's one of the other major takeaways from this season so far. And the last three was brutal. I feel like that's kind of its own thing. And I went Westbrook, LeBron, Durant, not necessarily on the logic of that that's the order that they've been in order of success this year, but Durant missing seven games more than Westbrook, I think that's enough to make the difference. And one thing that really stuck out to me was the statistical profile, and of course that's far from the only thing considered, for LeBron and Westbrook is not that different.
No, that's an interesting point. They do get both a lot of rebounds and assists. Russ obviously is shooting more than LeBron is, since he has a point guard next to him. My order was KD, LeBron, and Russ, and I could very easily be convinced to switch LeBron and Russ at this point. My thinking is I always, on these, just default to who I think is a better player, and then you better have an incredibly compelling reason to have someone who's a better player lower. I think now we've gotten to the point where those seven games that KD missed with the hamstring are not as important. I think he's just a little bit better than Russ just due to his efficiency. Russ, amazing usage, obviously, definitely critical to what the team is doing. He's played better on defense this year, though I still think KD is a better defensive player than he is. And Russ is still obviously a very, very good offensive player if you just look at what the team does when he's on the floor, even though he himself is not incredibly efficient the way these guys like Steph, Kawhi, and KD are. But I just would go with KD just by a hair because of the defense and also just being a little bit more efficient. And I think just as a better player, just having kind of reached a height in previous years that I don't know that Russ has reached. Why do you have LeBron at this point? Did you have him below KD? You had him above KD.
I have him above Durant. It was a really tough call. I think that his centrality to Cleveland is pretty remarkable. Even with Kyrie back, he's the linchpin of their offense. And yeah, his defense has been disappointing, but I don't think Durant has been much better.
Are you talking about LeBron's defense?
Yes.
I wouldn't say. What evidence is there that his defense has been disappointing? I mean, other than, you know, the fact
it's not what it was. It hasn't been bad.
I mean, I think their defensive performance as a team this year, especially considering some of the guys who've been out, Mozgov struggling, Shumpert missing a ton of time, I think their defensive performance as a team has been pretty good. And while he does get hidden on some of the best wing threats, and they'll kind of shoehorn Shumpert or even JR in there sometimes, I don't think he's been like a disappointment. I think he's, you know, maybe a little above average.
Yeah,
type of player, still
fair.
Pretty smart.
That's certainly fair. I guess it's a disappointment just relative to where he used to be. But that's all. Yeah. That Father Time's undefeated.
Yeah, I mean, that was always going to be the case. Well, we can talk a little bit more about those guys when we get into first team All-NBA, because those forward spots are going to be brutal between Kawhi, KD, and LeBron. Defensive player of the year, I assume you are sticking with Kawhi Leonard in this case?
Yeah, I'm not sticking. I haven't stuck with him as long as you have, but it's still the right call.
Yeah, you had Tim Duncan, I think, the first time. Tim has missed a bunch of time now, not playing nearly as many minutes as Kawhi. And we talked about this on the first month show, basically, that Kawhi, while he probably is not the best defensive player, I still think, you know, a big would be potentially a better defensive player. But when you look at the fact that Kawhi is just so much better than the other guys at his position, you can make the argument that he is potentially more valuable. That's just a recap of that. Who's your number two?
I guess my first thought is Draymond, but I'm not super comfortable with that.
Who are the other options?
Yeah, I'm Duncan's not played himself into it. Because what's so weird about this year is that no big man has stepped up. You know, we hoped that Rudy Gobert was going to get there, but he's been hurt a lot. I think it's Draymond by just process of elimination.
And the fact that his team is now second in defense, basically defending at almost the exact same level on a point per possession basis as last year. It's just that the Spurs are 4 points per 100 even better than they are.
And there's Boston, right? Boston was second for a while, but I can't think of which is remarkable.
Yeah, I mean, maybe you would look at someone like Jay Crowder, but they do it so much by committee. I mean, Crowder is probably the biggest constant for them defensively, but I don't know that he has quite the athleticism that you can really start to put him in that category yet. And I think when you look also just at the year-over-year defensive performance, I think you would have to say that Golden State and San Antonio are the two best defensive teams in the league, and it makes sense that their two best defensive players would be top two in this instance.
Sure. You want to move on to All-NBA?
Yeah. Steph and Russ in the backcourt, we can agree on that, right?
Yep.
Who did you have as your first team forward spots?
So for right now, I have Kawhi and LeBron, and I'm pretty confident that I'll have Durant there eventually, but for right now, I still think the overall body of work for Durant is there. It's a brutally hard decision. And the center spot is just weird. And I went for first team, I went with DeMarcus Cousins because I think he's been the best so far. I wish that I could have given that, like the All-Star game, could have given that third front court spot to Durant, but that's not the way the rules work.
Yeah, I think that that's right as far as the center. I had Cousins already, although I didn't feel spectacularly about it. But I actually had KD edging out LeBron, and ultimately I think the reason for that, I don't think there's really much of a difference between them defensively. LeBron's probably a little better in the post. KD is probably a little bit better switching, getting out on the perimeter, closing out on guys, and as a one-on-one guy probably even at this point. But I think that ultimately LeBron's inability to shoot now just makes him overall as a player a little bit harder to fit around. He's just not as multifaceted in this game as he once was, when you just can't really make a shot outside of 5 feet. And I think that's obviously something that is very concerning for his career overall. Still has been very good this year. Don't get me wrong. Still clearly a top five player, but I think that KD is just a little bit better than him now and a little bit more efficient as well. His team is just doing a lot better than Cleveland is as well. Although Cleveland, is not really, I wouldn't call their performance disappointing with all the injuries, but I think that Oklahoma City is clearly a much better team. And so with all that, I gave KD the very slight edge over LeBron.
Yeah, that's fine. Well, so it's totally fine.
Why do you have Kawhi as being better than both KD and LeBron?
I have Kawhi second in MVP. I think it kind of goes along with that.
Well, yeah, okay. But I guess we didn't really get into that too much as I think about it, of why you would have him higher than KD or LeBron.
I think right now you can make an argument that he's at worst the second best of those three players right now, and his overall impact on his team I think has been greater than them. And it is the line I lean towards: most outstanding with all NBA and most valuable for most valuable. And I think Kawhi's been outstanding this year too.
Yeah, it was tough for me because Kawhi does not carry the same offensive load that these other guys do. He's not running high pick and roll. He does isolate a fair amount, but his usage rate's only about 23%. That's much lower than LeBron and KD, who are up around 30% or so, and traditionally have been year after year. Kawhi is shooting an unbelievable percentage on these mid-range jumpers. You still worry about maybe how real that is, as this has really been his first year at that level. But also then you throw in his unbelievable defense, the fact that the team has defended so well, the fact that the team overall is doing so well, and then his true shooting percentage is like 62%. And I think if he did have to up his usage, he still has plenty of efficiency to kind of give back to where, if his usage was 26, 27, you still think he could be pretty efficient. You wonder a little bit about his passing. The other thing that we never talk about with him is that he never turns the ball over. He has like a 6% turnover rate or something completely ridiculous, which would be one of the not quite lowest in NBA history because his usage isn't that high, but definitely really, really low. So that's another thing that when you can score that efficiently and never turn the ball over, I think that's what gets you there, even if kind of he's not as spectacular as a scorer and distributor and not quite the traditional offensive threat as we would have thought.
So we have pretty similar agreement. We know already one spot on the second team. You know, each of us, it's whoever didn't make the first forward spot. Who are your other four?
Kyle Lowry and Chris Paul at the guards.
No arguments.
Paul has been unbelievable. He's the new guy in there, I think, from last time. He's been unbelievable keeping them afloat with Blake Griffin out. And for them to have, you know, basically be winning two-thirds of their games right now with the amount of talent that they have on the roster with basically three guys that they can trust with Blake out. I mean, maybe you could put Crawford in that category at times, but, you know, it's basically just a three-man team with DJ, Redick, and Paul. And, you know, just even that game that he had the other night against the Celtics where he had 35 points, he's just been scoring more. His usage is actually up from past years, still staying very, very efficient. They're still one of the best offenses in the league without really a ton of firepower creation other than him. I think he's been remarkable. And then at forward, I stuck with Paul George. The fact that he's shooting only like 42% or something on the year is a little concerning, but he still is taking 40% of his shots as threes, and he's hitting 38% of those. He can get a ton of those off. Still a very good defensive player on what's been a pretty good defensive team, and kind of as the main impetus offensively for them, I think he still is there. But a lot of that is still that amazing performance he had in the first month, and I could see him dropping off a level even further. Was he your second slot on the forward position and for second team?
He was, and I struggled with it. I mean, basically what I kind of settled down with was the guy who I think was probably next best is Paul Millsap, and I just couldn't find it in myself, you know, if you're talking about especially most outstanding. You know,
yeah, I think PG is just better than Millsap.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I think Millsap has had a great year. You know, I think I had him higher on my All-Star ballot than you did, that we both had him on, of course. I had him starting. And I can see an argument for that, but when you're really looking at those two guys, which is who I was looking at, Paul George just wins that.
My center was Anthony Davis, who has actually played more than 50% of his minutes at center now, according to our buddy Seth Partnow and Nylon Calculus's positional trackers. And if I were his agent, I would be banging down the media doors saying, hey, AD has been a center, AD has been a center, AD has been a center, because you got way less competition at that spot. And he has played center more than 50% of his minutes. Whenever he's playing alongside Ryan Anderson, which is their best lineup, he is the center. And he's definitely presents a lot of problems with his shooting for other centers. Still not a banner year for him by any means. And he definitely has to get dinged for the fact that his defense has been not nearly as good as it was last year. The fact that his team has been so bad despite their injury trouble. But at center, I don't really see, I mean, he's just so much better of a player than any of these other centers that I ultimately had to go with him. Bosch was my other consideration maybe for making that switch over to center, but he has played only about like 45% of his minutes at center, so that wasn't quite enough for me to vote him in there.
Here's a question for you. If you counted Davis as a forward, which we both agree that is not right considering he's playing a majority of his minutes at center.
And you could count him as either. I wouldn't say it's not right. He starts at power forward.
So. Okay, yeah, that's fine. So if you counted him as a forward, would he have made your All-NBA teams?
No, he wouldn't. He didn't last time, and I would have had him behind Bosch and Millsap, I think, just because his defense has regressed so much and the team just isn't doing quite as well. I mean, he's been pretty good in the box score stuff again, but not nearly as efficient as he was last year. He's only slightly more efficient than the league average now, which is about 54% true shooting. He's turning the ball over more this year, not getting any offensive rebounds at all, which is partly a philosophy thing. Definitely just has really regressed a lot. And with the team doing so poorly, I would rather reward someone like Millsap or Bosch, who are clearly the best players on teams that are pretty decent.
Yeah, we don't really have any disagreements with this. I actually hadn't thought about the AD at center thing. I thought about it the day after, or maybe even the afternoon after we recorded the last time, and thought, oh, crap, that's probably the way we should think about it. So the only difference for me is just that since I didn't have Durant on the first team, Durant's on the second team. Otherwise, we're in pretty firm agreement.
Third team, who are your guards?
Jimmy Butler, James Harden. And Harden, I had a little bit of a struggle with it. He, at the same time, I didn't have a person. I guess Damian Lillard would have been my next guy, but he makes this team in a kind of a weird way, like Paul George, where I didn't have a strong enough case for anybody else to take him off, but I didn't love putting him on, which is crazy considering the guy finished a legitimate number two in the MVP last year.
Kevin Pelton wrote an article today, actually, which is certainly worth reading, saying that Houston might actually benefit from trading Harden. I don't think they would ever do that. That would be a huge shocker. But that he has really regressed so much defensively. Houston is actually worse with Harden on the court this year than overall. I think they're negative 2.0 per 100 with him on the court and 1.8 overall. So that's certainly concerning. The fact that he's regressed so much defensively is a concern. If you look at just, and this is a very, very noisy statistic, obviously, but pure regularized adjusted plus minus, which is sort of the basis for RPM, but RPM also throws in previous year's performance and box score stats to sort of make it have less variability. But if you just look at solely the numbers with him, the on-off numbers for him, adjusted for the opponents and the players he's on the floor with, he's 292nd in the league as of a few days ago. Wow. So that is definitely a concern. Houston really taking a step back. Portland playing so well over these last bits. I actually went with Lillard over Harden. Okay. That may not be the case at the end of the year, but KP kind of convinced me, and I think, and ultimately, maybe it's just my frustration with how bad Houston has been defensively that's really kind of taking too much of the four here, and I'm penalizing Harden too much, but I don't know. So then your forwards?
Paul Millsap, as I talked about, he was the next consideration. And the last spot for me was between Chris Bosh and Draymond Green. I went with Draymond. I think that he's been a very...
Oh, yeah. You know what? I'm an idiot. How did I forget Draymond Green? That's totally ridiculous. He's got to be higher.
Well, so I debated him for second team as well, but and he's been a wonderful player. Like I should have mentioned him when I mentioned Millsap.
I mean, we had him on like at least the second team before. He hasn't been playing any worse since then.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
You know what? Yeah, that's terrible. I'm gonna because we're not gonna re-record this, but I will actually put him in
your second team.
I mean, there's so much competition at forward, too. You know, he's another one of these guys who would be great at center, but there's no way he plays enough minutes there to really
I think he's in the 20s or 15 or something like that.
Yeah, I'll put him over Paul George.
Okay. That's and fair. Then, certainly fair.
Yeah, and I guess, I mean, let's go with Bosch, and Millsap's going to be off now for my third team forwards.
Oh, poor Paul Millsap. And the center spot, DeAndre Jordan... Andre Drummond, what I originally, before I kind of really pieced together where Davis should be, it was an interesting 2-3 question, which became a 3-off question. And one of the, there are a lot of different kind of things I considered. And DeAndre's, you know, his PER isn't as great this year, which of course is not the most definitive thing. But we talked about how Chris Paul has been a lot of what makes them work. And I think DeAndre's role in that has in recent times been underrated. And they're better right now in defensive efficiency than the Pistons are. And I would argue that the Pistons have substantially better defensive talent around Drummond than the Clippers do with DeAndre.
Yeah, and Detroit really over their last 15 games is starting to crater a little bit defensively as well. You know, 15 games, the schedule can really influence that. But the Clippers, over their last 15, obviously this is a whole year award we're talking about, though, but since Blake Griffin went out, they haven't played a traditional power forward next to DeAndre at all. And Paul Pierce at the four, maybe Luke Mbamute is the only guy among those who are playing four or three for them that are decent defensive players at this point. And the fact that they have really managed to get into the top 10 in defense over the course of the year, Chris Paul obviously helps with that. But DJ, I think, has now really got to start getting some more credit for that. And his mobility, also his shot blocking, he's also the only guy on this team now who can get a defensive rebound. All of that really, I think, moves him up there. And then you also the fact that he Redick, and Paul, basically, his alley-oops can be the foundation of a good offense. And you saw what he did, for example, to those Celtics players, right? Like, you can't play a small guard on the backside of that pick and roll because they're going to throw it up to DJ and that guard's going to have no chance. He's going to get dunked all over. I think all of that is now, I'm finally starting to be a little bit more of a believer in him when we've seen now how good they've been even without Blake Griffin.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. And I know while I don't want to see them broken apart, it would be fascinating to see how his development kind of, or how his play changes with a less awesome point guard. I mean, playing with Chris Paul certainly helps. If you swapped Chris Paul and Reggie Jackson, I'm sure there would be some differences. But DeAndre has been a better player this year.
Biggest surprise team and player throughout the entire course of the season for you?
Oh, okay. I interpreted it as a biggest
over the last month.
Yeah, okay. I made it January specific, but it's the, sure, for me it was matter. The Toronto Raptors. The Raptors really stepped up in January. They were plus 7.7 in net ratings. That means they were outscoring opponents by a little under 8 points per 100, which was the best in the East. They played a lot of good teams. They played them well. And them establishing themselves there is a notable thing because when we did the mock deadline podcast, like, they can get to a place where they can really challenge Cleveland. And that's something I didn't see out of them when we were doing this, you know, theoretically, let's say we had done it on New Year's Day. I did not see that coming.
I'm not going to buy that yet. I think they're going to be a worse playoff team than they are a regular season team because a lot of their dominance comes from staggering their two best players. They've gotten amazing performances out of their bench when they're not going up against opposing bench units as much. I think that Cleveland has the ability to play their starters more minutes, and I think ultimately, even if Toronto does somehow get home court, which I don't anticipate that they will, I think that I would make Cleveland a substantial favorite unless we see more from Toronto even than we already have. For me, it was the Blazers and CJ McCollum. The Blazers outscoring opponents by over 7 points per 100 themselves in the last 15 games, and for this team to get to 500, even I think the most optimistic projections had them kind of in the mid-30s in wins. The schedule does toughen up for them a little bit, so they may take a little bit of a step back here. But at this point, I think that they, and then CJ McCollum as well, who only played 900 minutes last year, he's upped his usage to 27%, kept the same efficiency, and overall their team, 18th in defense, considering their personnel, is pretty darn impressive. And then 7th in offense, which and 3rd in offensive rebounding, which I don't think anybody really saw coming either. Just very impressive, and they are right in the mix now among those last, among all 5 of those teams vying for the remaining 4 spots in the West, those last 4 spots.
My player it's a little bit awkward just because I think both of us were a little bit higher on him than the projections were, but Nikola Jokic has done a really nice job this year, and he has established himself as a key part of Denver's front court moving forward, which is something that is legitimately impressive. One stat that I'm really impressed with him is that he has the second highest assist rate of any guy who's in the top 40 in PER who's a big guy. Blake Griffin's number 1, Jokic is number 2, and I think it's a pretty solid mile to number 3. And that is a really nice aspect of a guy to have. And I think eventually he can slide between the two big man spots. And I didn't see that coming this quickly, and I wasn't as high on him as some of the models were, but I did like him a lot, and to see that now is great. I'm really encouraged. McCollum, if you're going whole season, I think is a great choice.
He turns 21 on February 19th, which is pretty remarkable. He is 21st in the entire league in PER, almost 22. A guy that I need to watch a lot more closely just to see whether his defense can hold up or not. And I don't necessarily see him being able to play the 4. I think he might be even too slow to play the 5. Frankly, that's always been my impression of him. But maybe I need to just watch a little bit more closely. He is an unbelievably smart player, even at this precocious age. So it's possible that maybe he's just smart enough, like, you know, maybe a guy like Gasol, although he doesn't quite have the length and the heft that Marc Gasol does. But maybe he can be another one of those guys who just belies his relative lack of athleticism. Give me your biggest disappointing team.
So my team is for the month, but you could make an argument that it's for the year, and it's the Washington Wizards. And the Wizards, they weren't horrible in January, but I thought they could have made a run, and they just didn't. And the East has opened up, which is actually what I expected and why I've been positive on the Wizards for such a long time, is I thought they have the talent. I think they're there just from a personnel perspective, but they just haven't really brought it. And yeah, you know, teams like Houston and everything that's happened there, but the Wizards, I thought they had more of the structural stuff together to just to do it, and they absolutely have not.
Yeah, we had hoped that with Beal coming back, Nene coming back, this would be the time for them to finally make their run, start playing, you know, maybe 600 ball, get back into the playoff picture in the East. And instead now they really, another loss today at Milwaukee. That's the kind of game that you have to win if you think you're going to get back into it. And their playoff odds are really dropping, you know, probably around 20% now for ESPN, BPI, and then 538 had them is even much lower than that. So I think you're getting to the point where you really have to count them out. Mine, of course, is those Houston Rockets. I'm glad that you did not select them. They are a game under 500, a negative 1.8 net rating. So they really should be kind of more like 2, 3, 4 games under 500. And the offense, as you've noted previously, is actually better than it was last year. And the defense, which was 6th last year, is now in the low 20s, I guess the high 20s, it would be more accurate. And my disappointing player, which I think a lot of people wouldn't see this because offensively he's been okay, is Dwight Howard. And the reason I say that, it's not, you know, he hasn't been bad, but I don't think overall, but, and there are some other issues around it, but he used to just make an awesome defense on his own. I mean, when they were playing, Jeremy Lin was starting at point guard, they had Parsons, who wasn't any good on defense. They didn't have Trevor Ariza yet. Harden was at his nadir in 2014. Despite all of that, just because of Howard, essentially, they finished 12th in defense in 2013-14. He now is no longer that guy. I mean, when you look at Beverly, Ariza, him, I don't care who the other two guys are, you should still be able to cobble together at least an average defense with those three guys. But maybe it's just the case now that Howard, for whatever reason, is just not that force anymore. And that, even more than his offensive decline, which has also been somewhat significant, he's actually has a usage rate now below the league average. I think all of that is the biggest reason why he really, you know, probably should not get the maximum contract that he's going to be seeking. We'll talk a little bit more about that in the news section before we go.
My disappointing player is also a Rocket. It is a different Rocket, Terrence Jones. And Terrence Jones played in every game in January, which is wonderful. Unfortunately, I believe it was just January only. I didn't note that in my notes. He scored 8.1 points a game, 3.6 rebounds on 45.9% shooting, and below 20% from three. And he is somebody who I thought, you know, like when we did the rookie extension, you know, I thought he's a guy who had the potential to be at least a, you know, a decent, maybe low-end starter in the league. And he just hasn't brought it in that way. And yeah, he's missing time now with a concussion, but I narrowed it to January only. And he wasn't going to be the savior for this Rockets team for sure, but him or Demo, who's been hurt, and I don't blame him for that, had that possibility of kind of keeping this team afloat a little bit, and he absolutely has not.
Negative 8.6 net rating on the season for Terrence Jones. Rockets giving up 110.8 points per 100. The league average is basically around 102, 103. So that is really, really bad. It used to be that, and as you noted, he's not even really delivering in the box score stats either any longer. He just is one of the worst defensive power forwards there is, which is a shame given some of his physical tools. He's probably one of the worst post-up power forwards I've ever seen for a guy with his strength and athleticism. So he really just has to turn around. Probably one of the guys who's cost himself the most money with his performance so far this year. What we got next?
Rookie of the year. That's quick.
You know, it is. I still think, I mean, Karl Towns is 13th in the league in PER. He has a 59 true shooting percentage. That's ridiculous. Porzingis obviously is the competition, but it shouldn't. I still think it definitely is Towns, but we don't want to totally dismiss Porzingis just because, unlike most rookies and especially rookie big men, the Knicks have actually been much better with him on the floor. All the on-off metrics really like what he's doing. KP among power forwards is 7th in RPM. Towns among centers is 25th. That's not enough to swing it in my mind because Towns has been so much more efficient. He's been playing amidst some really miserable, weird lineups in Minnesota. But it is worth looking at a little bit more closely sort of the way that KP does have the advantage in some of the on-off team performance type of metrics over Towns.
For sure. Porzingis has had a really nice year. I just, when I watch Towns, I see, you know, you see something of a guy who can be, especially in that game, which I fawned over yesterday against the Raptors. Like that is, for me, having Towns above Porzingis is in no way a slight to Porzingis. In almost every other recent year, Porzingis would have been a pretty clean MVP, and Jokic is having a great year too.
Yeah, rookie of the year, you mean. But yeah, it's, I mean, this is obviously an unbelievable rookie class, and I agree with you. I mean, this is, I don't think that Porzingis is going to be anywhere near as good as Towns. Don't get me wrong on that, but just something to consider a little bit, that Porzingis has really been a guy who on a team up until recently was kind of hovering around 500, but has not been as much lately. All right, let's take a quick break and we'll be right back to continue after this. All right, a new feature for this month that I think we said we were going to do last month, best win of the last month and a half or so since we last did this.
Warriors over Spurs. I wanted to think about it. I wanted to go through stuff, but that was remarkably dominant against a historically great team, and it, for me, it was that.
Yep, I agree. I tweeted out at the time that was it possible that maybe this could be the best basketball that any of us were ever going to witness played by the Warriors, just crushing a team that had the best point differential in NBA history up to that point by 30 points. Just their defense was unbelievable. The way that Steph Curry was shooting in that game. And I mean, that was a team that other than the wins was statistically superior to the Warriors. And they just sent an unbelievable message. You got any honorable mentions?
Not really.
I would say Detroit beating Golden State by like almost 20 at home.
Yeah, that was a great win. And that was a healthy Golden State team. That's really their only definitive loss in that way.
Yeah. Worst loss.
So the worst loss, I'm narrowing it only to the January, but for me it was the Hawks losing to the Suns in the middle of their tailspin. It was a close game. The Suns only won by 3 in Phoenix, but
yeah, Paul Millsap didn't play in that game though.
Yeah, you know who else didn't play in that game? Eric Bledsoe, Brandon Knight, Markieff Morris, John Moore. The starting lineup for the Phoenix Suns was Archie Goodwin, Devin Booker, PJ Tucker, Len, and Tyson Chandler. And they won. Yeah,
Len and Chandler together, huh?
That's, yeah, and Phoenix's only win over the prior month before that game was when they beat the Hornets, who were playing without Batum, Michael K. Gilchrist, Al Jefferson, and Jeremy Lamb only played 7 minutes. So this was a team that was just out of it. And, you know, the Hawks are much better than that. And so for me, that was the worst one. You could go a lot of different directions, but for me, that's a gimme, especially for a team as good as them, and they shouldn't have lost it.
I'm going to empty another clip at the Rockets on February 6th. They lost at home to Portland 96-79. Houston had been a few games over 500 up until recently, and Portland was coming on. That was a game where they had a chance to kind of put Portland in their place. Secure at least, you know, 7th-8th playoff spot, and they were just never in that game. I think they trailed by almost 30 at one point. Even at the end of the first half, it was a total blowout. They only scored 79 points against a Portland team that is not an unbelievable defense, even though they've been better than expected. So that would be my pick for the worst loss since we last recorded on this topic.
Pretty debilitating, yeah. And especially when you consider that, you know, that loss has the added meaning in the standings because those teams are close right now.
So one thing we did last time was we looked at players that we wanted to watch. Yours was Aaron Gordon. What did you come away with? You always are a big Magic watcher. What were your thoughts on where he's at right now?
He's their power forward of the future, and I would, of course, prefer another center with him. I've criticized Nikola Vucevic a million times, but what is really encouraging about it, and this is something you and I have talked about not on the podcast before, is that to me there are two basic things that a power forward needs to do kind of in the next stage offensively, and that's they have to have a shot that's good enough to respect it, and he's getting there. I don't think he's necessarily all the way there. But when a guy closes out on you, being able to pull it back, take a dribble or two, and make the right decision, and he is closer to nailing that than I ever thought he would be at this stage in the game. And that's important because you're going to need a little bit more creation from him with their kind of weird guard situation, their shot creation situation. And so he's not all the way, you know, he's not this clear-cut superstar or anything like that, but he's bringing more on the kind of the edges of his game than I expected at this point. And his offensive rebounding, he has some spectacular tip dunks. And so there's a lot to like there. And, I've wondered about it, but he might be, you know, if we were doing a kind of a trade value column just on the Magic, I think he'd probably be number one.
Yeah, I think that's probably right. And he has looked pretty good in some of the PER type box score metrics. I think that what the flashes that he shows as a defender, especially I think as a guy who can be a good wing defender, who's going to be able to switch everything, all of that is encouraging. I must not have seen a lot of these games that you did because I haven't seen him with the ball in his hands all that much, and I felt like he's kind of been lost a little bit in that respect in the games that I've seen, but it's encouraging that in some of the other ones.
The Boston game in particular, it's fun because of my place as the Archbishop of the Church of Hazonia that people always shoot me messages when Hazonia has a good game. But that second half, the star of it for me was Gordon, and he did a lot of that against the Celtics team that is now third in defense.
Mine is Miles Turner, and we've talked about him quite a bit. He came in through Golden State, had an awesome game, had some really nice other games on their West Coast trip. But I think another one of these kind of rookie bigs where ton of potential, to be sure. I think he probably looks to me like maybe even the second best shot blocker, a guy who, if he actually gets off the ground and he's there, has maybe the second best chance of blocking your shot of anyone in the whole league behind Hassan Whiteside. His jumper has been great, but I do think he has a lot of flaws, some of which are being exacerbated by the fact that he's essentially playing the four now alongside Mahimi as Indiana has swung back to going big now. One is just that his ability to close out on anybody at the three-point line, anybody who can shoot a jump shot is going to be able to just blow right by him on a closeout or just get a wide-open three. So that's step one for him. Obviously, his defensive communication is something that he needs to work on. I mean, he's a rookie big. That's just what happens with them. And then offensively, he can get a little bit thirsty at times. He will just shoot. You know, it's not the end of the world to shoot a turnaround jump shot, but he will catch the ball, and that's just his first instinct right away. And it's not like he's catching the guy unawares either. You know, usually it'll be contested pretty well. I'd like to see him, and he doesn't have a ton of strength yet, but I would like to see him at least try to back down, fake the guy out a little bit instead of just, I'm just going to shoot over you immediately. The first pass that he throws in his next game might be his first pass of the year. So that's another thing as well. If you're going to be trying to have this guy create some offense, where if he's throwing more passes, then you can kind of live with the fact that he's just jacking up mid-rangers all the time. All of those are little things. He has a ton of potential. Just these last few games or so, he's kind of, those have manifested themselves a little bit more, but certainly a guy who has a chance to be a top 10 center in the league and maybe even higher than that, especially if he starts really honing that three-point stroke.
Do you have a guy in mind for this month? I have one if you haven't thought of it yet.
No, I haven't even begun to thought about it or think about it, for that matter.
mine is one of my draft guys, Emmanuel Mudiay. He's done a little bit better from what I've heard. I haven't watched a lot of the Nuggets in the last, you know, 2-3 weeks. And I watched a little, you know, I've seen bits and pieces with Jokic and things like that. But it sounds like he's getting it more together. And one of the things that I try to do in this time of the year, so when we get into February and early March, is I look at the teams that might not be as relevant in the playoffs, because it's kind of like a better time to get that snapshot than in April when, you know, teams that have, you know, tanked and all that kind of stuff. I actually really like to do that the 2 weeks before the deadline, but it got a little bit garbled this year because, you know, if a team like the Pelicans just blows it up, or the Suns or whatever. But Mudiay, I'm interested, and that will lead me to basically every other player on the Nuggets, which I'm interested in now.
Yeah, Mudiay, before he went down with that ankle injury, was basically having one of the worst seasons in NBA history, with his usage was like 28%, and his efficiency was like 40% true shooting. He's shooting like in the low 30s from the floor. It was really just totally miserable. Has never been a great free throw shooter either. But I think actually him sitting out, A, because he just got a chance to watch and kind of let the game slow down for him and not press quite as much, and B, because the Nuggets actually had more success with him out, and you had guy like Will Barton really emerged when Mudiay was out, and Gallo really got going as well. And so that allowed him to kind of throttle back with the usage, not be pushing it so crazy to shoot all these kind of fadeaway mid-rangers off the pick and roll. And now I think he's found his groove a little bit more. So yeah, I'm jealous that you picked him. I'll think on it, try to come back as we continue on here.
So the next thing we have is monthly trends, and one of the reasons I like having this in here is because it gives us a chance to look back on what we already said. And so we'll start with the ones that will continue. And so what I said last month was Houston's largely efficient offense. That has largely continued. They've done a pretty good job. And so they're still above last season's average in terms of effective field goal percentage for the month just of January. And they were tied for sixth in January for offensive efficiency. And my one for for moving forward is with the Brooklyn Nets. And I hadn't really thought about this. I haven't watched much of them recently, admittedly, because they're depressing. And their opponent free throw attempt rate, so basically how much the opposing teams get to the line, is shockingly low. It's kind of appallingly low. And when you really think about where that team is going, it's not really that much of a surprise. They don't have a lot of fouls there, and I'm intrigued to see how that works, because when you're kind of thinking about this team, a lot of those fouls come from the front court, and those are the guys that are going to stick around. And so that not fouling a lot isn't necessarily a good thing or a bad thing. Of course, it can be devastating, but I'm intrigued to watch how that goes.
Yeah, the not fouling, not turning the ball over, the sort of absence of negative plays are always a very underrated aspect in our evaluation of both individual players and teams. And I think a lot of teams, like Phoenix, is really the first one to say, hey, we're just going to not foul guys, and that's going to be a big part of our strategy. The Spurs now this year almost never foul as well with all the vets that they have and just the great defensive players. So that is just, in the abstract, kind of an interesting thing that is kind of made more interesting by the fact that it's sort of boring and unnoticeable on its own. My trend that I believe will continue is the Jazz being on fire. They got everybody back healthy. They were looking great at the start of the year. Then they had Gobert go down. Then Derek Favors missed like almost 15 games with his back spasms. And now really the only guy that they're missing anymore is Alec Burks, unless you're going to count Exum, which he's been out all year. So I think that they are going to continue to play well. I think they could even be a threat to get all the way up to the fifth seed and definitely the sixth seed as well. That victory they had, epic victory against Dallas on the road, really helped with that earlier this week. So I believed in this team at the start of the year, and I continue to do so. I think that they are going to be a force to be reckoned with for the rest of the year, especially defensively.
God, a 4-5 Clippers Jazz series would be incredible.
Yeah, it really would be. I would like to see them get up to that fifth seed and actually have a chance against a team that they could potentially be. I think they would be massive underdogs against the Clips.
For sure.
If Griffin were back. But yeah, I mean, that would be DeAndre and Blake against Gobert and Favors. That would be an unbelievable playoff series front court matchup. I really hope that happens. But you know, Memphis does have a pretty good head start, even with the Gasol injury, and can't count out Dallas yet either, or even Houston or Portland for that
even
matter.
Houston or Portland.
What is your trend that is an aberration?
Trend that is an aberration is, well, so first I'll talk quickly about the one that I said last time, which was the Thunder had the worst free throw attempt rate last month, and it improved to seventh.
You're talking about on defense.
Yeah, on defense. And they improved to seventh worst as their defensive efficiency fell. But, you know, that wasn't what I was talking about, and it was about right. My monthly trend for this is a little bit of cheating, but the Cleveland Cavaliers played the second slowest pace in the league in January. And not only is that not going to continue, it already has not continued, and that was a part of the changeover with Tyronn Lue. And Seth Partnow wrote that really interesting piece about the idea of half-court pace, but Cleveland, like Minnesota, who is another team that's really slow in pace, to me, their talent is so much better suited to moving the ball more quickly, and they're doing that more now, at least a little bit.
Yeah, I guess I was supposed to say what my trend was from last month.
You don't have to.
I'll save it until afterwards. Then we can get all nostalgic. But I mentioned that the Blazers were outscoring the opposition by 7 points per 100 over their last 15 games. That's not going to continue, especially with the schedule getting harder. This team is good, but I think they should be very happy about where they're at in the aggregate, but this team is not a team that's going to win games at, you know, a 55 win pace over the course of the season, which is about what a 7 net rating would translate to. So that's going to regress. And then the Heat, surprisingly, they're 7-8 in their last 15, but they have a negative 5.9 net rating during that time, and I think that will stabilize, and they'll at least get back to being average in terms of net rating.
And that includes a nice win over the Hawks, too.
I'm sorry?
They had a nice win over the Hawks, too.
Yeah, a lot of that is that Goran Dragic missed all that time with the calf injury. They really, really missed him. Whiteside was in and out of the lineup, and Tyler Johnson, although he may be out for almost the entire year, they didn't have him either. So I think that is going to stabilize. And then looking back on my previous predictions, I believe that the Magic's amazing start was going to level off. What did they go, like 3-15 in January or something like that? Or they, at one point they were 3-15 since January had started, and I think they're still only like 5-16. So that was correct. Less correct was my prediction that the Bulls would continue getting it together on offense. They, in fact, did not.
It's so hard to say goodbye to yesterday. I mean, that, the Bulls are just depressing right now.
Well, they have, I mean, four of their top six players basically are on the shelf.
Yeah. They're not the Nets, thankfully.
Yeah, and for all the criticism that Nikola Mirotic has gotten this year, he still is one of the best net ratings on the team. Even if he's not hitting a three, he still has to be guarded out there. His defense isn't as bad as everyone thought it was going to be, and I think they have really, really missed him as well, especially now that Noah is out also. So it's really and Noah, I think, actually helped Mirotic and McDermott offensively on the second unit, and now that he's gone, it's they just don't have the personnel. So I think their struggles are going to continue until Mirotic comes back, Butler comes back, and it sounds like those are both weeks away from happening still.
Are we ready to move on to news?
Yeah, what we got?
So to me, the biggest thing is Michael Kidd-Gilchrist. Wow, I almost went Michael Carter-Williams. MKG's MRI doesn't look good, probably done for the season.
Yeah, he has a torn labrum.
Just sucks.
Ugh. Yeah. And the thing about the torn labrum is at least there is some possibility they're saying that maybe he can come back and try to rehab it and play still, but that seems pretty unlikely. And maybe, you know, with them playing so well, but especially given like his rough and tumble style, trying to play where you're a lot of your game is sticking your hand in there and now your shoulder is going to get jostled every time. I mean, we've seen guys play with a torn rotator cuff, but a torn labrum is a much more severe injury as far as I can tell. You know, I mean, I think Howard played through some rotator cuff tears back when he was on the Lakers that one year, but I don't really recall anyone successfully playing through a torn labrum. So that's, if he does that, he's a badass. We'll put it that way.
Yeah. So do you want to go Dwight Howard next?
Yeah. Some things going back and forth. Woj reported that rival executives are saying that Houston is trying to move Dwight Howard. Moreover, Dan Fagan, his agent, is involved in those efforts, which makes a ton of sense because if you are trading for Howard, you want to at least have, we could, a non-cynic would say, some idea of what he might be looking for. A cynic could say basically an agreement on the deal, like everyone has speculated that there was with Goran Dragic when he was traded around this time last year. Dan Fagan then said to Mark Stein, and so did Dwight Howard, that, oh, no, I don't know what they're doing. I have not been involved in that. Dwight has not made a trade request. And that could well be the case that he hasn't made a trade request. But at the same time, if Houston comes to Fagan and says, hey, we're looking to deal him, you know, we'd like you to see if you can find him a home or, you know, a place that's going to be able to give him the contract that he wants, that's certainly something that should be involved. I don't think there's anything wrong with any of that, frankly.
Agreed. Something I've been thinking about since this kind of report came out is, do you think it would actually be a hindrance if you are the team that holds his rights? Let's say you much prefer him to sign a four-year contract. I feel like just from a psychological perspective, it might be harder to retain him on a four-year contract if you have his rights than if you don't.
The idea being that all of a sudden now 4 years is what you can offer, and that's essentially the same as what anyone else is going to offer.
Yeah, plus, it's just, you know, that, resentment of like, oh, well, they could do this and they're not. And just from a personal perspective, it's like, oh, they don't think I'm good enough, all that kind of stuff. I can see it. I'm not saying it's necessarily the truth, especially because they'd be leaving money on the table. But I can see the argument for it.
If it were me, and I don't know if this is something that can happen or not, I might try to get Howard and just offer him his maximum. I mean, he's in the 35%, so his max is going to start at 29%. I might just try to get him to bite on a 1+1 for the max.
If you could get him to do it, absolutely.
Yeah. Now, maybe not. You know, that seems like it might be unlikely. Maybe he's going to bet on himself. But I would think it is very unlikely that whoever he gets traded to, a team that is going to try to win this year, by the way, they would have his bird rights, but that they're going to re-sign him to 5 years, starting at $30 million a year, you know, over $150 million contract that's going to pay him through age 35. I don't know that team is out there.
And one of the big hindrances for moving him now is something that's a big change with this landscape, which is that there would be a sweet spot if there were teams that would not have had the space to sign him outright. And, you know, then could really use bird rights to, you know, as a way to get him. So if you acquired him now, you'd say you had enough salary to make it work, and you could do that. But so many teams are going to have so much cap space that there isn't a market in that way like there was before.
Also, a report from Chris Haynes that Ben McLemore is not necessarily on the market. If you really read the article, he says that the Cavs, among with a handful of other Eastern Conference teams, have strong interest in trading for McLemore. So that doesn't necessarily mean that he is on the table. He is a guy who has some athleticism. I think if he were on a winning team, the fact that he can hit open threes and not a great defensive player, but has the potential in terms of his physical ability to defend at least an average level, is someone you might want to try to target. But I think if I'm Sacramento, I still try to hold on to him a little bit longer and see, you know, especially if there's going to be a new coach. I mean, what are you going to get back for him? Are you going to get a first-round pick for him?
I don't think so.
At this point, if you could, I would jump all over that if I'm Sacramento, because they really need to replenish those picks, and it looks like he is not working out. But, man, I mean, they already just dumped the number 8 pick in 2014, Stauskas. McLemore is looking like essentially a sunk cost, the number 7 pick in 2013. If those guys were just looking like they could even be a quality bench guy and were still on the team, they would be in so much better of a position than they are right now.
And that's such a big part of successful team building when you're in a smaller market, is that you don't need to hit on every pick. I mean, we're not saying they need to, you know, draft Giannis at 15 or anything like that. You just getting a guy who's a rotation player just provides you a cheap base of quality, so then you can spend your money in smaller places. Of course, they also had bad money spent in a lot of places, like the Carl Landry contract and things like that. But if you're a small team, you have a much tighter margin, and they just haven't done it.
Yeah. Chris also noted that if Joe Johnson gets bought out in Brooklyn, Cleveland will quote unquote snatch him up for the veteran minimum. I'm not sure if that necessarily would happen, especially because Oklahoma City, I think, has their full mini mid-level that they could use. There are some other teams that could actually offer Joe a little bit more money than the Cavaliers could. And actually, maybe even in the case of Oklahoma City, both a better team, although probably won't play as long into the playoffs as the Cavs will, but also more playing time. You know, I'm not sure that Joe is better than J.R. Smith or Iman Shumpert, and he's really, you know, almost like a 3-4, kind of his best positions now on offense, and you got LeBron there as well, Kevin Love, whereas in Oklahoma City, they'll probably at least give him a chance to earn as many wing minutes as he can handle.
If I were Joe Johnson and the minimum was really what was on the table, I would rather go to the Clippers than the Cavs.
That's another one, too. Yeah, if it really is going to be the minimum, that's another team that could use perhaps his skills, although he is incredibly redundant at this point in his career with Paul Pierce, and playing those two guys together, I mean, they're just going to be absolute traffic cones defensively. So that's a little bit of a concern as well, but I'm sure Doc would be happy to snap up another player who he may recall had a great playoff series against the Celtics in 2008.
Yeah, I remember, who was it mentioned the idea of wondering if Gallinari had played a good series against the Clippers, and I think he did have one like really nice 30-point game against them in like 2009 when he was on the Knicks.
I think we're done here. Anything else we got to talk about?
No, can I make a plug?
Yes, you can. I assume it's going to be Jim Barnett, the Warriors color announcer on Real GM Radio, which I can't wait to listen to myself.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun to do. Jim has been the Warriors announcer, I believe it's for 27 years, just a wealth of knowledge. But we talked about the Warriors for the first half, and then the second half, he played in the NBA for 11 years. We talked a lot about the way the league has changed, how players from when he played would compete now, and he spends about 8 minutes telling wonderful Wilt Chamberlain stories, which was just delightful for me as somebody who loves the history of the game and who thinks that Wilt's stature has kind of faded a little bit just with our generation with the lack of video. And actually,
yeah, he's too low in ESPN's NBA rank,
right,
for my take.
And so, like, there was a Real GM, I think it came out of the out of the message boards. There was a thing about your kind of most entertaining starting five, and I included Wilt on mine. And I was shocked that I got so much of a response to people like, oh, why'd you have Wilt instead of Shaq and all that. It's like, when you watch young Wilt, you see something that nobody else has ever really been able to do.
I agree with that. I've had a lot of just those type of conversations with Jim just hanging out in the media room at Oracle Arena. So I'm sure that's going to be absolutely fascinating. I urge everyone to listen to that. And I also urge everyone to patronize our sponsors, Helix Sleep and SeatGeek, with that cap space code. And follow us on Twitter at NateDuncanNBA and Danny LaRue. Programming note, we'll probably take a little bit more time off due to the All-Star break, but I think we'll be back early next week with a couple, and then it'll be trade deadline time. We'll have all sorts of real trades to analyze instead of just mock trades like we did early last week. So we'll talk to y'all next week then.